Ernest Becker is a man who, in 1974, published a book called The Denial of Death, which won him the Pulitzer Prize in the category of general nonfiction. It was a late entry into the Pulitzer Prize Committee deliberations. I talked to one of the judges on the subcommittee of general nonfiction about 6 months ago, and he said that they were under an incredible mountain of books. One of the three members on the subcommittee had sustained a concussion when one of the tomes fell off the head of his bed and hit him on the head at night. And The Denial of Death was submitted after the deadline. And this man read it, and he said it was like an explosion going off inside. And he recommended it to the committee that they considered, even though it was a late entry, and the committee hemmed and hawed because, in the words of one of the members of the committee, I don't like to read heavy philosophical tomes, which is an unusual statement for the Pulitzer Prize Committee, I thought. But at any rate, it did win the Pulitzer Prize. And by the time the decision was announced, Ernest Becker was dead of cancer. One book was published subsequent to The Denial of Death. It was published posthumously, called Escape from Evil. And it's obvious that Ernest Becker considered Escape from Evil to be a postlude to Denial of Death, and he considered that they were one work. He had published many books before, half dozen, all of which are very good, but as he says in the introduction to Denial of Death, this is my first mature work. And it's an extraordinarily exciting work. You can feel in reading it Ernest Becker's own excitement with what he's discovered and what he's been able to put together. He was a social anthropologist and he was a social psychologist, and he was widely read on the humanities. And this book is a synthesis of what he learned both as a student, as a scholar, as a professor, and as a human being. I think that to start with Ernest Becker is a difficult task, and I will try and cover his very rich thought in about a half an hour. Mr. Becker started seeing man as a paradoxical creature, out of nature but hopelessly in it, a god who shits. Not just an animal that knows that he dies, but a being capable of self-transcendence. Not an animal, but an animal. Not a god, but a god. Who recognizes that he is irredeemably alienated from being an animal. Who feels special and unique and knows deep down inside that this unique difference from nature is truth. And so Becker calls this paradoxical nature, these two things put together, man's creatureliness. Death, to Ernest Becker, was seen as the annihilation of man's specialness. The annihilation not only of man's significance as an individual, but the annihilation of the significance of humanity in general. Death shows that man is not a god. He already knows he's not an animal. But in the fact of death, man knows that he's not a god. And so man is alienated both ways. He's not an animal, and he's not a god. And so man is lost. This is quite different from somebody like Freud, who saw man as an animal and saw death as being an instinctual fear related to the preservation of the species. And so death was a biological crisis. In his analysis of Kierkegaard, Becker points out Kierkegaard also saw death as a theological crisis, a crisis of meaning, not a crisis of biology, not a crisis of an animal, but a crisis of a creature of meaning. Kierkegaard also saw man's anxiety at the ambiguity of the situation, which Kierkegaard saw as secondary to man's fall into self-consciousness. And Kierkegaard saw one of man's ways of dealing with that as being shut-upness, which I'll talk about later. In the psychiatric literature, the concept of neurosis refers to a large collection of syndromes, all of which have in common a free-floating anxiety, an anxiety at nothing in particular, not an anxiety of standing underneath a rock that's suspended by a thread, but an anxiety just at being. And it's distinguished, the neuroses are distinguished from the psychoses in that the neurotic is in contact with reality and the psychotic, the schizophrenic, is not. And so there are a whole bunch of responses to neurosis. We're all familiar with Lady Macbeth, with her sense of guilt, trying to wash out the spot on her hand, which really isn't there. Becker says that neurosis is a characteristic of humanity. It's a universal problem. It's an anxiety that we all feel. And each individual in his life is called upon to make a response to their anxiety. And Becker goes even further than that. He says that culture itself is a response to try and deal with the anxiety that man finds himself in. And the response to neurosis is called the causa sui, the underlying cause, the underlying project which each individual and each culture must deal with. And the sick neurotic is one, the neurotic who's symptomatic, is one who still feels this anxiety and is overwhelmed by it. And the hidden neurotics are those of us who suppress our anxiety and have found some successful way of dealing with it. Let's go on to the concept of repression. Repression to Freud was a different thing than repression to Becker. And all through this book, there's this tension of Becker trying to work Freud together with Kierkegaard. It's a phenomenal struggle. Repression to Freud was the balancing of instinctual drives in order to cope with reality. Repression, for example, of an overwhelming sexual desire in order that one could get one's act together enough to go out and earn a living. And Freud saw culture as being built up on repressed energy popping up elsewhere to build skyscrapers. And so repression to Freud was a biological phenomenon. It repressed biological instincts. To Becker quotes over and over again a single sentence by Otto Rank, who was one of Freud's disciples. Man is a theological creature, not a biological creature. And so repression serves a theological function, not a biological one. Repression is used to suppress our anxiety about the paradox, the ambiguity of our position. We are alone. We are not animals. We are not God. The meaning of our existence is not evident. We have no meaning. And so repression is what allows us to function in spite of this anxiety, in spite of this feeling utterly at sea. And so Becker equates psychological repression with what Kierkegaard calls shut-upness. And one of the great bridges is to take this psychological repression and equate it with Kierkegaard, shut upness. It's a remarkable thing. But Becker goes beyond that, because if he just did that, then you'd have man as being kind of a fearful creature always running, and whose final motive was to protect himself from fear. And that's been a line in existentialist thought. It's been a rather common one. Becker says there's another side to man. There's the problem of heroics. Becker says that man has two, what he calls, ontological motives, and that'll be the last time we use that big word. He says there is a desire for people to identify with the cosmic process, to feel a part of the cosmic process. And the second motive is a desire to be a unique and a significant individual, as the individual that one is. Not to be engulfed by the cosmic process, but to be a part of it even while being apart from it. And thus Becker can say, in a non-cynical fashion, the idea of God has never been a simple reflex of superstition and selfish fear, as the cynics and the realists would have claimed. Instead, it is an outgrowth of a genuine life longing, a reaching out for a plenitude of meaning. How a person solves his natural yearnings for self-expansion and significance determines the quality of his life. Becker's not a cynic. He doesn't say that man is motivated only by selfish fear, but also is motivated by a genuine search for meaning. And this puts the balance, makes at least a balance. It doesn't shift things entirely in man's favor. It's not the same thing as saying man's innately virtuous. It just says that he's not innately evil. And so then Becker talks about what he calls heroics and the causa sui, which involves both repressing the anxiety in order that we can function and fulfilling the twin ontological motives. He talks again about repression. The great boon of repression is that it makes it possible to live decisively in an overwhelmingly miraculous and incomprehensible world, a world so full of beauty and majesty and terror that if animals perceived it all, they would be paralyzed. This despair we avoid by building defenses, and these defenses allow us to feel a basic sense of self-worth and meaningfulness and power. And so we get to the problem of culture as a causa sui. Culture is as repressing the anxiety and fulfilling the motives. And Becker looks at a lot of data. There's Hitler and Nazi Germany. There is the corporation man of IBM. There's patriotism. There are people who absolutely, totally live for a particular model of what a family means. And there's the whole interesting connections of God and country, master race, both evil and good. You know, many, many different groups that we join, mass movements that we join. Becker says, culture is sacred since it embodies the transcendence of death in some form or another, whether it appears to be purely religious or not. And then he says, in another part of Escape from Evil, transference heroics gives man precisely what he needs, a certain degree of sharply defined individuality, and a definite point of reference for his practice of goodness. In bringing the cosmic process down to earth, for example, in participating in a master race or the destiny of America, something like this. We bring this cosmic process that we want to feel part of down to earth, and we make it more tangible. And we also make more tangible the way our significance of an individual, as an individual, is affirmed. So the two motives are satisfied. And also, the anxiety is repressed because our country will say to us, for example, to use that one, you are meaningful. You are an American. Or IBM will say, you are meaningful. We need you to make our quota. People need these things to survive. They need the anxiety repressed. They need the motives fulfilled. And they'll even settle for IBM. Or they'll even settle for Nazi Germany for their meaning. Man wanted a visible God, always present, to receive his offerings, and for this he was willing to pay the price of his own subjection. And Becker says transference is only not good insofar as it's reflexive and not conscious. He also talks about fetishism. Fetishism is, again, another process of making something that's too large to grasp small enough to manage. Some fetishes for the evil in the world are to make something that's attacking the particular hero system that you're buying into the ultimate evil in the world. And I think a really good example of this is the outrageous reaction to long hair. Now, long hair is basically a string of polymerized protein which hangs from the top of one's head. And yet long hair became a major cultural issue in this country. Why did it become a cultural issue? Because long hair symbolized an attack on a heroic system the large number of people bought into. And so long hair became a fetish, one of many. Communism's a fetish. The incredible, in this country, obsession with germs is a fetish. Sex is a fetish. Then there's the question of religious heroics. Becker was not a man of faith. And one feels in his books a real sadness over this as he talks longingly about religion, which he was unable to have himself, or unable to feel himself. He makes some extraordinary statements. God, as a cosmic being, by his love for us, is able to affirm our part, our being as being a part of a cosmic process. And God, in his love for us as individuals, is able to affirm our individual significance. In the Christian religion, we don't have to merge with the cosmos. We are affirmed as the individuals that we are. And we are also the anxiety of death and meaninglessness are both negated in the Christian religion. And I think that maybe Becker was a little scared by that. I think one really interesting quote. Christianity took creature consciousness, that sense of anxiety I was talking about, the thing that man most wanted to deny, and made it the very condition for his cosmic heroism. But anyway, Becker, through his books, he longingly builds up this description of the Christian religion, and it never bites. And I think it's significant in that regard that Soren Kierkegaard himself said that he was not a knight of faith. He simply didn't have it. I think that's one way to look, perhaps, at Ernest Becker as a secular writer. Finally, Becker talks about our culture today. And if I could just find a quote here. Becker sees our culture as having done away with the sacred dimension. And there are a number of reasons why we did this. One was because we couldn't tangibly measure it with our electron microscopes and all the rest of it. And so we have embarked on the causa sui on our own. We've tried to create our own meaning, which is precisely what we're not very good at. That's precisely why we're neurotic, why we're anxious, because we don't have the meaning within ourselves. And so we have secularized our daily life, according to Becker. And he says, it begins to look as though modern man cannot find his heroism in everyday life anymore, as we did in traditional societies just by doing our daily life of raising children, working, and worshiping. He needs revolutions and wars, and continuing revolutions at last when the revolutions and wars ends. And this is the price that modern man pays for the eclipse of the sacred dimension. An ever-increasing spiral to make transference heroics work, to find some new place to fix our cosmic significance, which isn't transcendent, but which is within the historical process. And it doesn't work. Meaninglessness and free-floating anxiety are not valid complaints in our society, which is trying to carry its meaning on its own and is terrified to admit its own failure in it. And sin or being out of grace are concepts which are completely unintelligible to a society which is without the two dimensions of the sacred and the secular, which relate to each other. Sin doesn't make sense in a one-dimensional society. And so our anxiety has to be brought into the causa sui. It has to be secularized. We don't have anxiety over our place in the universe. Instead, we have breakdowns in our psychological mechanisms. We were toilet trained wrong. We were raised in the inner city. We had too much food additives. That's what makes us anxious. And the other side of that is the reason for our anxiety is we aren't involved enough in the heroics of our culture. So after the psychological technicians, the social workers, and so forth get through fixing us up, if we really want to get rid of the anxiety, we've got to participate more in the heroics. We have to buy more, earn more, achieve more. We have to get more involved in the heroics so we can forget our anxiety. And so finally Beck comes to an astonishing paragraph. Here, Otto Rank and Soren Kierkegaard meet in one of those astonishing historical mergers of thought, that sin and neurosis are two ways of talking about the same thing. The complete isolation of the individual, his disharmony with the rest of nature, his hyper-individualism, his attempt to create his own world from within himself. Both sin and neurosis represent the individual blowing himself up to larger than his true size, his refusal to recognize his cosmic dependence. Neurosis, like sin, is an attempt to force nature to pretend that the causa sui project really suffices. But we know that this attempt is doomed to failure because man simply cannot justify his own heroism. He cannot fit himself into his own cosmic plan and make it believable. He must live with agonizing doubts if he remains at all in touch with the larger reality. Sin and neurosis are the same thing. Well, that's an introduction to Ernest Becker. And I hope you'll be around tomorrow to talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Has anybody else here read any Becker? John, I know you have. Anybody else? Okay. What else did you get out of him?
What's his position of guilt? I guess you know this a lot better than I do. But he gives guilt a very important position in his argument. What is that position?
Becker talks about guilt and expiation, and what he seems to mean by that is man's always feeling out of place, like the guilt of going to a party where you're not invited. And so man seeks to resolve that guilt by entering into a bargaining system with the universe in primitive societies, whereby, for example, in giving sacrifices to God, man is paying God back for making the rain fall. And so his sense of being out of place is relieved by becoming a part of a cosmic process. And that seems to be the kind of guilt that Becker's talking about.
We get rid of it, you know, in modern society by sacrificing to...
No, he says that modern day sacrifice is more done out of a desire to fulfill heroics than to relieve guilt, which is why our sacrifices today don't seem to work. He talks about because we don't admit a cosmic anxiety in a secular culture. The term doesn't make any sense. And so our guilt today is seen as a breakdown or failure of heroics. It's not seen as being a basic cosmic anxiety about meaninglessness.
Mm-hmm. Can you clarify a little bit more what you mean by heroics? What he means by heroics? Is that the word that he uses?
That's the word he uses.
I'm not quite clear on that.
Becker says that man is not only ambiguous, but that he has this yearning. He's not only out of place and anxious about that, he has a yearning to be in place. And the attempts of people to fulfill that yearning is heroics. Heroics are the effort of a person to carve a place for themselves in the destiny of the universe, or in some larger meaning, without sacrificing the value and significance of one's individuality. And that carving a place out for oneself in the universe, or in some cosmic meaning, is what is heroics.
Does a society dictate this acceptable heroics?
That's right. He says that's exactly what society and culture does. For example, to use the really obvious example of Nazi Germany again, which is overused in ethics courses just because it's so clear-cut, Hitler created the myth of the master race, the Aryan destiny,
the which was seen as an intrinsically meaningful, the summing up the destiny of man, all earth was really a prelude and a stage and a support for the destiny of the master race. Now that's heroics, any way you cut it. Anybody who participates in the destiny of the master race is participating in heroics, because they're becoming a part of a cosmic process. People will settle for very little in the way of heroics, Becker points out. He says that people so much long to have a place, they feel so out of place, and that their hunger for a place is so great that they'll settle for almost anything that will give them a place.
Now, in referring to Nazi Germany, you said cosmic. You used the word cosmic. And is that, when you use the word, when he uses the word cosmic, does that refer to a more primitive state? Rather, is cosmic over against secular?
Well, there were just really strong religious overtones of Nazi Germany.
Well, is that then different than our present culture, which he calls secular?
What he is saying is that... This comes to his idea of transference, which is the idea of making something a larger thing than it is. For example, making Hitler's philosophy of the master race into a cosmic process. That was a sacred thing.
Well, then, is there an impulse, even in people in a completely secular society, to sacredize things?
That's right, that's right. As a matter of fact, he says exactly that. He says, I think I have that quote right here. He says, culture is sacred since it embodies the transcendence of death in some form or another, whether it appears to be purely religious or not.
So is there a big difference between contemporary secular culture and primitive culture?
Yes, the difference is that our culture, a purely secular culture, tries to avoid the question of meaning, because whereas a primitive culture or a religious culture, the Christian tradition or the Jewish tradition, is not afraid to deal with the question of meaning, because it says meaning is out there. Meaning is secure, because meaning is outside of the human condition. Whereas in our culture, where we try and pretend that we're totally self-sufficient, by that I mean, you know, a secular culture in general, the United States culture in general, where we try and pretend that we're entirely self-sufficient, that through our knowledge of science and psychology and sociology and all this stuff, that we are the answer. We don't want to deal with questions of meaning.
But when you come up with the concept of a master race, aren't you turning into a discussion of meaning?
That's right. That's right. Which is what. But you see, what he did, what Hitler did, was he said he started from within the culture, generated the concept of master race, and then pretended it was outside of the culture and everybody related to it. See what I mean? Rather than Hitler saying the master race concept is this, and we are, I'm going to get in trouble doing this. The difference, I think, that Becker would say, is that there's something stable. There's something that calls the culture to be responsible to it, in a meaning that's outside of the culture. Whereas in a secular culture, there's nothing to call the culture to be responsible to it. And the master race was clearly a concept which didn't call Nazi Germany to be responsible to it, It was a concept that was just exploited to generate all this. It was whatever Hitler said it was.
Well, is maybe the difference that not everybody believed in the master race? And in a primitive society, there's no question of belief?
One other difference, just real quick, and I think that is a difference. I mean, the consensus was much clearer in primitive society than it was in German society, but in the Nazi society, they had a primitive consensus, you know. But one of the differences, I think, is that in the primitive society, it worked better in giving the person a transcendent meaning to be a part of the tribe. Also, the person kept his individuality better, I believe. And then in the big nation states that we have now, we, instead of getting both, for transcendent meaning, we end up losing the other thing that we want from a heroic, you know, project, right?
What's that?
We lose our own individuality within that.
Mm-hmm.
We in a sense are the secular state, the picture of transcendent meaning and or the individual's relationship to this big project,
mm-hmm,
is not an individual putting something on the altar, but 10,000 people walking in the same beat.
I think, though, that Bruce, you're right. I think that Becker says there is no difference. I think that he talks about, you know, it all is the same thing. It's all a matter of heroics. It's all a matter of an illusion, a creative illusion, what he calls a creative illusion. And I think that the difference is that the difference, he would say, the difference between a secular and a sacred culture is rather arbitrary. It's just a question of whether the culture says that the final meaning is outside of itself or is totally identified with itself.
I was thinking when you were saying that, something. If we're a culture that says and absolutely believes the first article of the creed, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, then whatever you are, God made you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a culture that doesn't quite believe that, then you have to make yourself into what your culture wants you to be. And in that, you're coming from within the people rather than from without, from
mm-hmm
outside.
Mm-hmm.
I think about there being the same. Each culture has got, or society has got, the same blanks.
That's right.
They fill them in with different things.
That's right.
And the Nazi society is maybe more clear,
mm-hmm,
you know, the blanks. That's why it's used so much. But even in, I think Becker would say that the blanks that we have to fill in primitive society are the same ones we do here. We have the same projects. We get the same thing out of it. In a sense, anything that makes us feel righteous is a part of this transference, isn't it?
Becker says that the problem is the same for every human. The feeling of not belonging, the anxiety over meaninglessness,
mm-hmm,
and the need to feel a part of a cosmic process. Those
mm-hmm
problems are the same for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
The solution to them must be both individual and also cultural.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, he says that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he doesn't make a lot of distinctions between sacred and secular, except insofar as a purely secular solution, which is ours. Even Nazi Germany had religious pretensions. The purely secular solution breaks down.
if you boil, you know, boiled what he's saying down, how is righteousness a part of it? Seeking righteousness, a part of his statement of what drives man.
Define righteousness.
Well, he uses it, doesn't he? Somewhere.
All right, give me a...
I'll chase it down.
All right.
Let the conversation continue.
Anybody else? Or Bruce, you got more?
One thing about the righteousness, he says that the self-justification leads up to a psychosis.
That's right.
What's that?
Self-justification leads to psychosis.
What do you like?
I think that's a really, brings up an interesting facet to Becker. Is in his book, he also has a complete theory of mental illness, which some of these clearly out of his field, but I think that his way of relating some mental illness to failures of failure of heroics is really fascinating. For example, he says that depression is really a failure. Depression is a failure of heroics. Depression is a feeling that one does not have a role in the cosmic process, that one is cosmically insignificant, is also a failure to repress the basic anxiety. So depression is not merely something that is a disease, in the sense of an organic disease, but is a failure of heroics. And I can recall one example from when I worked on a psychiatric board that I just totally impressed me. A guy called Tom, who went around and he literally spent his entire day listing his sins. And he went around and he said, well, I robbed the Coke machine at work. When I was a kid, I went into a drugstore and I stole a candy bar and didn't tell anybody. There was some wood piled up outside the place where I work, and I took it without telling the boss, even though it was trash. I should have told them because it was theirs. I have looked at women with lust, like Carter. He just went on and on and on. It was the most tedious, boring rap that you can ever imagine. After you heard Tom for half an hour, you'd heard Tom all day. And the response to this was, well, Tom, you are only human. Well, you know, when you think about it, that's a kind of a standard response we give people who are feeling inadequate. You're only human.
It's also the easiest way, isn't it?
Sure, but what does that say? Gosh, you're only human, you poor thing. So anyway, they're trying to do this. Everybody screws up, Tom. You're only human. Anyway, and naturally, Tom didn't get any better. But one night I was on call, and Tom wasn't my patient, so I'd had nothing to do with him. The nurse, other than being his confessor whenever I walked through the halls, but the nurse called me because there was something wrong with Tom. He wasn't taking his medicines, which is one of the major indications that there's something wrong with somebody in the hospital. And I went to Tom's room, and he was lying on his back in bed, staring up at the ceiling. And like a fool, I said, Tom, is anything wrong? And Tom started his rap again. And this time, out of desperation, I said, listen, Tom, do you believe in God? And he said, well, yes, but I never went to church. And when I went to church, no. Anyway, but I said, Tom, I want you to know that you are completely forgiven. There is nothing you can do about it. You are forgiven. You have screwed up in all the ways that you said you've screwed up, but you are totally forgiven. And this tear came down Tom's eye, and he sat up in bed in a space of literally less, just seconds. And he gave me a great big hug, and he said, "You know, I felt like there was this vice squeezing my head, and now the pressure's gone." Mm-hmm. I'm saying, "What? What's this?" And it was astonishing. And unfortunately, it broke down again. But nevertheless, I think that's that whole event says something really interesting about depression and Becker. Anybody else?
You're talking about the cause of suicide, and I can't recall the context, but explain what that is and the cause of suicide. What's that?
I don't know the roots of the word. Does anybody here know Latin?
Well, it sounds like the cause of things.
Sui is reflexive.
Kind of
itself. It's self-generated.
Okay, that would fit. He says that the causa sui is the basic underlying project, the thing that every individual must do if they are to survive.
In other words, work on himself?
That's right. He must, in order to function as an individual, repress his anxiety at how absolutely alone he is in the universe. If he admitted everything, if he admitted how anxious and alone he felt, he would not be able to function. And he also must fulfill those two heroic drives.
If he admitted to who? Himself?
Himself. He says, this despair he avoids by building defenses, and the defenses allow him to feel a basic sense of self-worth, of meaningfulness, and of power. The great boon of repression is that it makes it possible to live decisively in an overwhelmingly miraculous, incomprehensible world, a world so full of majesty and terror that if animals perceived it all, they'd be paralyzed to act. And so that's what the causa sui is. It's living in this world that we feel totally out of place with and just totally overwhelmed by.
Is that like inventing order?
That's right. That's right.
Superimposing an order.
That's right.
And what we were afraid of looking at.
He sees the causa sui as making a creative illusion.
And we got a little. I was looking for this other thing, but I just bumped into one definition. This causa sui project is definite and inflexible, the securing of immortality, in whichever way this is understood by the individual and the society. Sense you're dealing with good works, but you'll never believe that the work is good unless something bigger than you tells you that. And so whether you're in a community or small state, nation, whatever, you're getting a definition of good works, and in a sense it's works righteousness, where someone outside you tells you what's good, and you attempt to, and you make it your project to be good, in according to some group bigger than you, and you feel that having done certain things, you are participating in the cosmic meaning, and you are becoming immortal in some sense, and it's particularly. I think Luther is, I don't know if Carol's going to do that, but there certainly is a book to be done with Luther's theology and Becker, because so far I can't see anything that Becker's doing but writing the history of the old Adam and the old Adam that goes to church too. But that's he's telling what Luther means by the old Adam. What's he like, and how does he go about achieving ends? And I guess Becker does say that if Christianity lived up to its promise, it wouldn't be so much achieving ends as receiving all these things. And that's your starting point. Having received everything that the Kazusui Project is supposed to give as your papers in your baptism, now go out and in a sense, in a Christian sense, to hell with the Kazusui, go out and love.
That's right.
But not the good works, not the righteousness, not the sense that you don't do something so that you feel righteous. And somehow my nature is I always link myself, I want to feel righteous about what I've done. I want to cling to that righteousness or that justification. He uses those words a lot. I want to cling to justification by something besides faith. And I think Becker's writing about justification by something instead of faith. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm looking for that quote because it's beautiful. Statement. Self-esteem is the equivalent to righteousness. He does have that. That isn't the one I'm looking for.
The last major remark you made last night was about his equation of Freud's neurosis with Kierkegaard's sinfulness, which I thought was really very interesting. Could you review that?
Yeah, I think that first off, Becker reworks Freud. He calls it recasting Freud. By the time he gets through recasting Freud, Freud's been significantly altered in several major respects. In a way, you get the feeling from reading his chapter on recasting psychoanalytic ideas or something like that, that he has done an inversion of an old speech that kind of goes like this: I have come to praise Freud, not to bury him. And by the time he gets to recasting Freud, Freud's been buried.
Interred.
Yes, interred and cremated. He claims to be a neo-Freudian. But anyway, neurosis is the state of anxiety, the state of meaninglessness, the state of feeling out of place. The response to that is to try and cover that up and to fill the heroics. Sin, Kierkegaard's concept of sin, is engendered by our anxiety at our ambiguity that we perceive because of our fall into self-consciousness. Let me go through that again. We are ambiguous. We have no place. We have fallen into self-consciousness. We are aware that we are ambiguous. And that makes us anxious. And for Kierkegaard, our response to that is shut upness. One of those awkward words that makes Kierkegaard so impossible to read. Our shut upness, we try and shut up that self, that awareness of how untenable our position is. That's one half of sin. We try and cover up that we're out of grace. The other half is the really destructive way that we go about covering it up. The way that we puff ourselves up to pretend that we are the whole meaning. We run muck in the universe, or at least on the planet Earth, and maybe if we figure out how to travel to the stars, we run amuck, we might run amuck in the universe. But we're running amuck on this planet, trying to prove that we have meaning, because we're neurotic, because we're out of grace. We sin. And I think that's the equation that he's working from. Unfortunately, he is working for that equation with almost no knowledge of theology. He quotes Kierkegaard, and he quotes one book of Niebuhr's, and he quotes Tillich. And other than that, all the resources and the millions of footnotes are all secular work. I think that he might have done a little better than that if he'd had some more theology. But that's the argument he's making, and it stands by itself. I don't mean to apologize for him. Is that clear?
Yeah. In the synagogue where I worked, the rabbi would often talk of sin as falling short. I don't know. Is that something that is used in the Christian definition of sin also?
I think that the Jews had more of a covenantal idea of their relationship with God. The idea that there's kind of you fulfill your end of the deal and I'll fulfill mine. Yeah. And so I think that falling short would be more from covenantal type language. Whereas I think in Protestant thought, the concept of more is it's totally God's free grace. And so there's not that covenant.
Don't we, in reality, isn't the fact that we sin that we do fall short?
Yeah. Well,
I got to get something in here. The Hebrew has three meanings of sin. And those three different kinds of sin are translated into sin in our Bibles. And there, one is a nature sin, being bent and twisted out of shape in order to perform proper function. Same word you'd use to a screwed up window. You know, it's warped, doesn't open. The same word is, you're bent and twisted out of shape. And another one is, the other major meaning is that you break the communication with God. It's like a line going up. Yeah, you cut that off. That's another major meaning of sin. And the third one is that you jump outside where God would have you live. You know. I mean, you, instead of living, and he would have you live in a system, in a world of value, and you jump outside that. Now the guy that you was talking to you was saying falling short within this place.
Yeah.
And that's what sin is. And yet, that isn't, that kind of sort of particular sinning is better than jumping out of that.
Rebellion?
Well, it's just leaving. See, we can say, aha, there's no such thing as value, absolute value in the world. We're outside. In a sense, we're outside the dignity of error. Where the guy's sinning, that guy who's falling short has the dignity of air. If you jump outside where God would have you live, there's no meaningful sense of sin, but there's also no dignity of being human. But if he's stressing that kind of sin that falls short, he's stressing a sort of a particularized sin, of a simple act kind of thing. We could have done better, but we didn't know how short we did this. You know, this, we did this thing. And that is a sin, but it isn't one of the primary meanings. Just being bent, cutting off communication, and jumping out of where God would have us live. And that's the Hebrew conception. It's not necessarily a Christian conception, I think it is, but yeah. But that's the Hebrew conception of sin.
I was thinking of that in terms of heroics. You try to do the right thing to be a hero, and you fall short, and then you are anxious because you fall short. Now that's almost like trying to get a touchdown and not making it, and being depressed about it.
Yeah, I think that the what you're talking about, though, is perhaps an idea of justification or even sanctification by works.
Yeah.
The idea that our heroics can give us a place in the universe, which is certainly one illusion, one of the answers to the Causa Sui project.
Well,
but it's not the only one.
That isn't. You were talking about the guy in the hospital. He has fallen short. He's done these things wrong. And perhaps because of that, or because of his reaction to that and his loss of belief in his place, he is psychotic. Maybe I'm simplifying that too much, but unless I'm getting this wrong, the gospel does say that if you could do it all right and you never fell short, you would be saved. But you will always fall short. So you're put in a pretty anxious predicament.
Does the gospel say that? I don't think the gospel says that. I think the gospel...
Well, doesn't he say he who is sinless can cast a stone? But there's not one among you who is sinless.
That's right. That's not using... The idea of sin is not a relationship to a behavioral code. Sin is inherent in our position.
Yeah.
I think one thing, you know, like you said, that's a kind of an irony, I think, part of a Christ's irony. And there's only one passage I can think of that shows that's irony. You know, when he says, those of you who haven't sinned, cast. I mean, as if there was one. And he also says, I'm coming to this. And I don't come for the righteous, I come for the sick. You know. But when somebody calls him a good man, see, in other words, a righteous man, he says, don't call me righteous. No one but God is righteous.
Yeah.
No one but the Father is righteous. But is there. Now, that's coming from him, so that,
yeah.
You know, everybody else is not, he's not talking about a world in which there's such a thing.
But in order to have a concept of not being righteous, I mean, in order to be able to even use that vocabulary, doesn't there have to be an ideal that is perfectly righteous? Someone who would be sinless and who could cast a stone? I mean,
I know.
There has to, I'm thinking there's got to be something that you fall from, that you fall short of, something that was intended for us, maybe, you know, like falling out of the Garden of Eden because you fall short. I mean, why would we need to be saved if we weren't less than what we should be? And that should is a big word.
I don't think that we can. I don't think that we can know or even speculate on what that is.
But isn't the fact that we do speculate on that I mean, how could we feel that anxiety unless we had an idea of what we should be? We had an idea of what our heroics would attain to, if they worked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. Well, I think that we have an idea, and I'm not sure where it comes from, that we should be a part. We should be as meaningful as we wish to be. We should have some solid basis for feeling belonging. And we should have some clear perception of our belonging, of the meaning that we participate in. And we don't have a clear perception of God. He's a mystery. Maybe that's it. Does that matter?
Yeah,
I think also that longing, it comes also from the fact that we are apart from our Creator, which if you are apart, there is a missing, you know, which is a yearning and creates a drive. Even if it's unknown, I think, because of the power of the creation and the power of God.
The reason that I was asking this question in the first place is it seems in the experience of people that I know who have had a lot of psychiatric counseling and therapy, that where it's fallen short for them is where the psychiatrist or therapist has tried to reassure them that they were okay and has reasoned with them to where they would be okay and it's all right, there's nothing wrong with you. But the person went away, and after that euphoria wore off, they were aware that actually they weren't okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly what Becker says about a secular culture. He says, psychiatrists are not priests. They aren't ministers. They don't know that person's okay. They don't have the authority to speak the word to say, you are okay. You belong. You are significant. Psychiatrists don't have that authority. And so what do? They deny that the whole question is valid. And that's exactly what Becker says. That's exactly why a psychiatrist can't expiate guilt. He can't sanctify you.
And they got to break that. You got to break it down because, or say that it isn't really there, because otherwise they're impotent to do anything about what causes people to get in the situation they're supposed to be able to help.
That's right.
And the beautiful phrase in the movie The Ruling Class, where a guy asks the psychiatrist what does this mean? He says, oh, don't ask me meaning. I have explanation. Don't ask me what it means. All I have is explanation. And you'll have to go somewhere else. And yet the meaning is the crisis. And the explanations always do fall short. And I think that even if you can convince the guy, this Tom, that he's okay, you know, that he's forgiven, there's the sense you've got sort of, if he's that sensitive about his own guilt, he's probably that sensitive about the races. And he is going to have Ivan's difficulty with the fact that some child is killed by its parents, and says, if hurt over that too. And I my own situation, I felt, you know, guilt was very much a part of it, but it was essentially, guilt is a part of the race. And seeing, I mean, you get a picture of the, you know, 10,000 kids being beaten up right now, probably on this planet. You know, and you see them at once in your mind, and you very imagine, you know, and you know you're not, it's not like fantasy, you're seeing, you know.
Mm-hmm. And actually, that's what a lot of, I've spent...
You're guilty about being a part of the race.
Part of that, that's exactly right. A lot of psychotics have that imagery. They say, because I took away, or because I did some minor insult to somebody, there's a war going on in Bangladesh.
No, thank you.
That's almost a quote. And you hear it again and again and again from psychotics. Just fascinating. Freud can't explain that. Becker can. But I wouldn't go so far as to say Becker has the explanation for schizophrenia.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I think that he's got some explanation of some symbols that we haven't been able to touch yet with a Freudian type of approach.
It sounds like if but if guilt is the basis or is the reason for psychosis and the reason for neurosis, then, I'm not familiar with world religions, but it sounds to me like Christianity, the basis of it is the forgiveness of guilt, and the removal of guilt is the only answer to that. And I don't know what other religions.
Yeah, well, I don't know that much about mental illness in other societies, but I think that it's interesting to reflect on some of the things that psychologists and sociologists have been talking about over the period of time in our culture that has coincided with a decreasing number of people who believe in the Christian answer. Like sociologists talk about anomie, an interesting word that means without the word, literally, but actually when sociologists use it, mean a breakdown in the cohesion of the community, a sense of alienation from the community, something that has coincided with the breakdown of a sense of the city as being a community of Christians who are going to their own churches. Certainly depression has been increasing dramatically over the past few years. I suspect that if you plotted the decreasing percentage of the number of people who are going to churches versus the number going to encounter groups, therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists, and all these, I suspect you'd find a curve that looks like this. And I suspect the total number of people involved would be about the same. But I don't know about other religions, how they handle the problem of guilt. So maybe if we have any Muslims or other Shintos, Buddhists, any Shintos or Buddhists in the room?
He does somewhere talk about Buddhism in terms of its... It tends to wipe out the...
rather than deal with a split, wipe it out, and erase it, make someone, I guess.
Yeah, there are a number of different strategies. For example, the secular approach might be to deny that we have anxiety or meaninglessness. Mm-hmm. Another approach might be to deny that one of the parts of the heroic drives, to deny that we have a desire to affirm our own individuality. Say all we want to do is merge, mm-hmm. which, you know, is in line with mm-hmm. with Buddhist thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another approach might be to deny that we have a desire to be a part of a cosmic conscience, to say that's just totally generated by our fear, and that our only drive is to affirm our individuality, our naked individuality, in spite of the meaninglessness. We have no desire that all religions and all desires to be a part of a cosmic process are just solely generated by our anxiety. And the only drive that we really have is to affirm our naked individuality. That is Nietzsche. And not, you know, that's Nietzsche. That's exactly what he says. And so there are lots of ways you can slice up that causa sui by denying that those different things exist. Try and make it work. And Becker says that all of those three parts must be affirmed.
Does he talk about in a practical sense, related, an individual relating to his community or being apart from it?
I don't understand.
Yeah, you talk about an individual being isolated from having a place in the universe, but does he speak of an individual being isolated from his immediate community?
He talks about, to the extent that it's better if you have a group of people who are all sharing the same solution to the cause of sui, so you can all tell each other how right you are. And that's what a mass movement is.
Does he evaluate that as positive or negative? Or
He doesn't evaluate much as being positive or negative. He says it has a potential for both. If you have a whole bunch of Ku Klux Klanners telling themselves that they are the way, the truth, and the light, that can be a very destructive thing. On the other hand, if you have a group, say, like a church, or family, that can be a very constructive thing, a very nurturing thing, a real constructive illusion or barricade against anxiety.
Well, is it, I wonder, is there a sense of guilt that separates a person from his group, his family, his community, his school, his church, something like that?
Oh, I see. No, he doesn't talk about that.
Doesn't he say there's a guilt of being?
Yeah.
I mean that there's a guilt that we feel just because of the qualities, personal qualities we have, whether they're sort of, you know, socially positive or socially negative. There's a kind of guilt that guts you either way, just because you're there.
Yeah.
You know, and he traces it back just to there, and he takes it a step further than that crazy thing about he says we feel guilty because we have heads. Heads stick out. and we project that, you know, we feel guilty about that, and we project it on yours, and we cut yours off and take it home. We participate in the strength, you know, this kind of there's a kind of a power thing about that. I'm not dead, you are. And at first it's just ludicrous, but then at the time he gives that example, he's already
made it a very meaningful analogy to large sections of the book, and that's laid in the book. It's terrible to go looking for neat passages because there's so many, and I still can't find that single statement about righteousness, which seems like it comes right out of Luther's commentary on Galatians. And many of the things that he's saying, Luther's talking about commentary on Galatians. And it just almost kind of a nervous laughter that results from having a psychologist say and discover that guilt, sacrifice, heroism, and immortality are the key concepts for the science of man and society. And to have discovered that when so much of that is within the Christian tradition and very similarly understood.
Mm-hmm.
It's spooky.
But not surprising. If the Christian image of man is correct, then it must at some point be verified by psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Christian religion must have a valid psychology of man.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what the psychologists find, I think what's neat about Becker is he's a synthesizer.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't get off on he doesn't become either Rank, just Rank or just Freud or just a Jung. But he tries to put it all together and put it in with historians and sociologists and all kinds of folks. And in him we get to see what these disciplines do study and what history is. Mm-hmm. It's, as far as I'm concerned, the study of the old Adam. And the ways of old Adam with old Adam. The way men work out their guilts, their struggles on each other. And so in a sense, there's nothing that a psychologist can find that's true that isn't a part of the old Adam. The problem is to get one who gets a number of sides.
Yeah.
And then this, why he's so exciting is that he's got a sketch with good proportions. He's got it blocked out really beautifully.
Well, it sounds like you'll be hearing a lot about Becker when Carol gets back.
Carol, yeah.
So why don't I leave this to Carol's excellent hands as he explores with you the relationship of Becker to Luther. And I guess I'd just urge you all to go out and take a look at Denial of Death. It'll be in the bookstore soon. And have a good evening. Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun for me.